Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. I'm Gary Gramling.
And I'm Jenny Brentis.
And we are starting off our Week 9 Sunday recap with what went down in Kansas City. We're going to talk about the Chiefs and what went on with their quarterback and what's going on with their offense. We're also going to talk about a quarterback who did not participate in this game for reasons that you might have heard of. But we're going to start this one off with Jordan Love, who was forced into action for his first NFL regular season start. And, not great. It didn't go great.
Yeah, Love definitely struggled. I think it's important, though, to look at the bigger picture. And he was put in a situation that was really difficult. On the road in Arrowhead Stadium, which is a tough place to play, even when the Chiefs aren't at their peak, against a defense that blitzed him a lot. Whatever you think of how the Kansas City Chiefs defense has been playing this year, Steve Spagnuolo knows how to get pressure and generate pressure, and they certainly were able to blitz a lot on third downs, which played into the woeful third down conversion rate for the Packers. Also, you know, special teams had a lot of miscues in the first half. And Love didn't know that he was going to play until Wednesday. And most of the week was dominated by this maelstrom that came out of the fact that Rodgers had misled people about whether or not he was vaccinated, and then took to a radio interview with a friend to try to explain himself, but ended up spreading a lot of misinformation. So it was just not an ideal circumstance for Love to make his starting debut in, Gary. And certainly there were things you could criticize about Love's performance. His ball placement was off in a lot of different situations. He was definitely green, which showed up in critical game management situations. So yeah, he has a lot of work and development to do as a player, but ultimately, I don't know that we should be holding this up as a critical data point necessarily, just given all of the other stuff that's going on around him.
No, it's a great point, and I'm glad you brought up the Chiefs defense, because we're not going to sit here and pretend that this is the 85 Bears defense, but statistically they're not good, but what they do, the way they approach opponents, it's a really tough defense for a young quarterback to break in against, especially on the road. A lot of, like you said, a lot of blitzing, a lot of disguise looks. They can do a lot of things that really force a young quarterback to think twice after the snap. So that was one issue there. Two missed field goals. That's not going to help. And the other thing was no takeaways in this game, which is a storyline for the Chiefs, but it's also a storyline for the Packers, because, you know, at some point, if you're going to win this game on the road against the Chiefs, and we'll get into what's going on with that team right now, but you are going to need a player or two. You know, a big player or two has to come, whether it's in the form of defense or special teams or from your quarterback. Jordan Love just isn't really in a spot right now where he can deliver those one or two big plays that you need to win a game like this on the road.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. The defense did have some good stops, the Packers defense, but you're right. They didn't get that takeaway that gave them incredible field position. So that made things harder for a team that was already facing an uphill battle. I mean, one thing I wanted to point out too, Gary, is that Aaron Rodgers' argument this whole offseason was he didn't have enough pieces around him, or that was one of the points of frustration that he had, that he didn't have enough input on personnel and there wasn't enough around him. And Love had less around him if you look at it in the fact that two of Aaron Rodgers' most prized assets that he plays with are players that he has excellent chemistry with, right? Davante Adams is a top receiver, but he also has this incredible uncanny connection with Rodgers. And one of the moves, or the only move that Rodgers had input on, was bringing back Randall Cobb. They played together for 8 years before. And so again, they have that security blanket. Jordan Love doesn't have any of that. I mean, Davante Adams was asked about his connection with Love this week, and he basically was like, yeah, we don't have any connection because we haven't played together, so it's going to all be new, right? And Randall Cobb, you know, same thing. So if you think about that those are the two best things Rodgers has, but he still doesn't think he has enough, and then Love doesn't even really have those things, it also helps put his performance into context. Not saying he's going to end up being a great quarterback. Certainly, there's an argument to be made that he's been in the NFL for a year and a half. He's had that time to learn from Rodgers, and Matt LaFleur is a great coach, and maybe you would have hoped that his development would have been a little bit farther along. But I do think it's hard to make too much out of this one performance because of all of the other things we've discussed.
Yeah, I mean, you still saw the flash of some of the traits, whether it be some of the balls he was able to get off under heavy pressure, or some of the ways he was able to escape and extend plays. I mean, those things were there. The other thing I just want to mention, it's funny that the way it's gone for the rookie quarterbacks this year, specifically Trevor Lawrence, Trey Lance, Zach Wilson and Justin Fields, the guys who were, the quote unquote traits guys compared to Mac Jones, they've all struggled this year. That hasn't been the case with all these guys in the past, especially in the recent past. But I think because of that, maybe you think twice before saying, they gotta find a new quarterback in the future. Again, Jordan Love certainly didn't establish himself as the guy who's going to be the heir to Aaron Rodgers in this game, but he also didn't disqualify himself. And I think if you are the Packers and you did believe in him during the draft process in 2020, I don't know if this necessarily knocked your thought process off onto another track.
Yeah, I think that's really well put, Gary. And whatever decision the Packers and Rodgers make this coming off season, which basically the renegotiation of the terms of his contract this past off season set it up so that there is going to be some kind of decision made. Either they move on or they give him an extension to lower his incredibly large cap number for 2022. It's certainly not going to be based solely on one spot performance by Jordan Love. There's going to be a ton that goes into it. And it's obviously a very complicated situation with a lot of factors. So I just think this one November performance shouldn't be held up as having too much value. But because of the way that Jordan Love entered the NFL, because of the way the Packers handled it, because of the frustration that created on Rodgers' part, because of the fact that they traded up to get him and didn't just take a player that fell to him, for all of those reasons, there was going to be a lot more pressure on this one game. But I just think it's important to remember that it's not the end-all be-all. It's not what's going to ultimately make the Packers' decision on what their future looks like.
Well, let's talk about an offense that they really need to tear down. Again, new quarterback in there, and that's the Chiefs. So, look, this was as we all know, the Chiefs were leading the league in turnovers this year. This game was the first time since the season opener they did not have a giveaway in the game. So that is the positive. The negative is that it's just not quite there. And my argument to people is obviously not to tear this down, but I don't think they're nearly as far off as it's being portrayed. I think this is a slump they're in the midst of. I think they've gotten by because they played some sort of undermanned offenses over the past couple of weeks, and that's allowed them to stay in it. But there's a ball toward the end of the game to Tyreek Hill. It's a yard beyond him. I mean, it's a missed throw, but it's tough to really look at that and say like, oh boy, big problem here. Maybe things aren't quite as wide open as they have been over the years. The offensive line obviously is not quite what it was, but we've seen some mini slumps from Patrick Mahomes, maybe two games, maybe not three games, but I still just don't think it's that far away from clicking for them. Maybe I'm being delusionally optimistic at this point.
Yeah, I think it's actually a similar issue as the conversation we're just having about Jordan Love, where you're comparing Love's debut as a starter to Rodgers, who's the reigning MVP. We're comparing the Chiefs as they look now to the Chiefs as they looked the past two seasons, which there's a big difference there, right? They looked nearly unstoppable the last two seasons, and they are rolling out a lot of offensive concepts that were exciting and new and we hadn't really seen before. And like you said, Gary, there were seemingly receivers just screaming across the field open on every single play, and defenses have adjusted. They are asking the Chiefs to do different things, and Yeah, I think the connections have been a little bit off. I think Mahomes has been a little bit off. You know, his accuracy hasn't been quite as perfect as it had been the last few years. You know, maybe you kind of get into this street ball mode and you sort of rely on being able to make those plays until you realize that that isn't the foundation of an offense, even though it's felt like that the past few years. And, you know, maybe a player or two is, you know, the guys around Hill and Kelsey, he doesn't seem to trust as much. And then teams are doubling Hill and Kelsey, and that's limiting other options. I don't know exactly how to parse out, can they just snap out of it quickly or not? I agree with you that they're not that far off, but then again, they haven't been able to fix it to this point.
They had two passing plays of over 20 yards, actually two plays of any kind of over 20 yards in this game, a couple of throws to Travis Kelce, which I guess was good after he had the rocky Monday night game where he didn't do a whole lot. But, that was it. You know, Tyreek Hill's longest receptions, 13 yards. That's not the Chiefs offense we have come to know and love at this point. But, there's work to do, and luckily for them, we are in week 9 of an 18-week season, and they still have their bye week coming up, and they are still certainly hanging around in what is a wide-open AFC at this point. And this was a big game to steal against, when we looked at the schedule early in the year, this was when you circled as, what a matchup of Titans this will be in Kansas City, even if one guy wasn't there. And speaking of that guy, we don't need to fully rehash what Aaron Rodgers said in the Pat McAfee interview on Friday. It's already been covered just as much as it could be covered anywhere. He has been mocked in many different ways at this point. But it was jarring for a number of reasons. But I guess, I don't know. I guess to me, it's just the fact that you're sort of not taking responsibility for your choice is what sort of sticks out. And we're not going to get into bodily autonomy versus, you know, what the league should do and what the union should have bargained, et cetera, but he knew the consequences, and now the consequences are falling upon him, and he just seems to be desperate to shift this blame onto anyone and everyone else.
Yeah. He said in the McAfee interview that he has an allergy to one of the ingredients in the mRNA vaccine. I think he could have, if that's the case, he should have specified the ingredients and said he was allergic to it and didn't want to get the J&J vaccine. That could have been included in a tweet, right? Like, if that was the case, he could have just put that explanation out into the world, maybe answered some questions or said, I didn't mean to mislead. I was still, you know, challenging this and hoping to get a different resolution, whatever the case may be. But instead, he did a very long and rambling interview that was less about saying, hey, this is a situation versus making an indignant rebuttal to what he called cancel culture or the woke mob, and also spreading a lot of disinformation. So when we talk about the maelstrom that Jordan Love was dropped into, that interview was part of it. I mean, we saw Matt LaFleur was visibly agitated about it on Friday when he was asked, rightly so, by members of the Green Bay media. That's all anyone was talking about Friday over the weekend. All of those things make it more difficult for a player like Love to enter the game. And certainly there's a bigger discussion to be had, more important topics than the circumstances under which a player makes his first start in the NFL. But that's, again, why it's impossible to hold this up as a really representative sample size, to use Gary's favorite word, because this was like the most unusual circumstances you could have made your debut in ever. It wasn't that the quarterback tested positive for COVID-19. That has happened, on teams the last year and a half. That's become part of playing the NFL during the pandemic. But it was the fact that he misled and then offered a explanation that turned into an attack on other people, essentially.
Well, like the guy he listened to, I feel like our podcast, maybe a few dozen more downloads is what we need, and then we can start dispensing medical advice that people will listen to. Maybe that's where we're headed toward.
Titans Rams.
So yeah, we just spent like an entire week wondering how the Titans would fare without Derrick Henry. Would their offense still be able to play at the same level they were playing at before? And it just kind of didn't matter on Sunday night as they go out to LA and the defense, a defense that quite frankly didn't look very good early in the season, just absolutely dominated this game.
Yeah, I mean, the plays that they made against Matthew Stafford and the Rams really just changed everything in the second quarter, the two turnovers back-to-back from Matthew Stafford. But even later in the game, just getting critical stops, getting pressure on Stafford, you know, stopping them on a fourth and one when they had to stop them, there were some really impressive plays by the Titans defense. And the physical nature with which they play the game, I mean, that's really what Mike Vrabel has brought to the Titans. If you talk about how he's been able to turn the team around, it's really this identity on both sides of the ball that you can just overpower the opponents. And we worried how they would still be able to do that without Derrick Henry on offense. But this was an example of how they did this in the game overall, starting with the defense.
On one of the summer shows, we were joking around about Jeffrey Simmons, who we all recognized was a really good player, and I'd sort of thrown out, you know, he's kind of has that Aaron Donald flavor to him as, like, potentially really dominant guy on a defense that just maybe isn't very good around him, but maybe he just takes over some weeks, and that's the way it goes. And that is definitely the way it went on Sunday night. I mean, Simmons was Aaron Donald good on that side of the ball, and I'm not sure what was going on up front with the Rams, but we haven't seen them look this bad on the offensive line in a game in a very long time. But also, you know, even when they didn't get to him, Matthew Stafford was patting the ball a lot. It is just not an overly talented secondary outside of Kevin Byard, and they're making it work. We kind of have to see what happened on the All-22 to know exactly what they were doing, but whatever they've been doing the last couple of weeks, I mean, they've sort of, you know, they've gotten the better of Patrick Mahomes, now they've gotten the better of Matthew Stafford. It's Mike Vrabel is just doing a pretty exceptional job at this point with this group.
Yeah, well, Gary, you were the one who made the prediction about Jeffrey Simmons, and I give you a lot of credit. I mean, he was an ascending player, a guy that's on the precipice. I mean, Gary Gramling would be a general manager who's like, he's ascending, let's pay him before he gets to that level where we have to overpay him. Like, that's the key, is to recognize the talent when it's on the way up before everyone else realizes it. So credit to Gary. But yeah, he really has been a difference maker for the Titans up front. And as you said, if you don't have a lot else in the secondary, but you can have that presence up front, that covers up for some of that.
Jeffrey Simmons on defense, Jacoby Brissett on offense, and we've got ourselves a couple of Super Bowls coming up on my imaginary team. Look, the Titans offensively, I don't know if we got a whole lot in the way of answers in this one. It's a really good Rams defense, so I'm not sure what kind of broad takeaways we would want to make regardless, but this game turned on the two really uncharacteristic Matthew Stafford interceptions. One of them set up a short two-yard touchdown, very Carson Wentzian turnover by Stafford, and then on the very next play, Kevin Byard gets the pick six, just absolutely reading Stafford in a way that you just don't see that happen to, like, savvy veteran quarterbacks. Byard knew exactly where that ball was going, like, out of the huddle at that point. But other than that, this Titans offense, you know, Adrian Peterson, it was neat to see him out there. He didn't do a whole lot. The younger backs looked better than him. And then Ryan Tannehill, yeah, it was kind of sort of okay. You know, the issue with him is all those windows are going to be so much tighter, and he was already a bit of a tight window thrower, but they're tighter almost to the point of non-existence now that Derrick Henry isn't there really sucking up that linebacker level. I don't know. I mean, they did have two sustained drives. One of them was built largely on roughing the passer calls. I don't know what they have offensively going forward here.
Yeah, I would agree that this game was certainly not an answer to that. I mean, the Titans found a way to win, and that way was the defense. But you're right. A lot of the questions we have about what the offensive identity will look like without Derrick Henry are still there, because he was not only the foundation of the offense, he was also their closer, their home run hitter. So he was unique in that way, that he was so many different things that you don't always see a running back be. I mean, right? When is your running back your home run hitter? That's very rare to see in today's NFL. But yeah, Adrian Peterson, pretty quiet night, but he scores the touchdown in the fourth quarter that really put things away for the Titans. Of course, as you referenced, there was a very questionable roughing the passer call in which Aaron Donald basically had like a very light two-handed push on Ryan Tannehill. And I don't really see any world in which that could be a penalty. There's other questionable calls sometimes that come up. Like last week was Mac Jones, but you could see, at least in the spirit of the rule, there was very slight contact with the helmet. It was not significant in any way, but you could see at least with that call, they were saying, okay, to the letter of the law, any contact with the head and neck area, no matter how slight, qualifies. But this, I just don't see which criteria it meets for roughing the passer. And that ultimately, as I said, kept that drive alive for a decisive score and really made it so that the Rams weren't going to be able to mount a comeback.
Sometimes you just feel it in your heart. That man has been roughed is what you say to yourself, and you just throw a flag. That one was bad. And look, obviously that did not affect the outcome of that, the game, to be clear. It was just, boy, it was a head scratcher.
Once the Rams didn't convert the fourth and one, it was basically over at that point. But it was like the final nail on the coffin, perhaps.
Yes. And it was the, you know, as they said multiple times on the telecast, the Rams had been the least penalized team in the NFL. They had 12 for 115, which is just a staggering total for any team, let alone them. And Jenny, I'm glad you mentioned the big play ability of Derrick Henry and how he's our home run hitter. Longest play for the Titans tonight was 16 yards. And again, no big broad conclusions to draw here. They were playing with a lead basically for, you know, the last 35 minutes of this game, 40 minutes of this game. If you had questions about the offense, you still have questions, but maybe you're just looking at the defense being like, this might be a much better unit than we thought it was.
Broncos Cowboys.
So it was a day of heavy upsets around the NFL, and we were starting with not the biggest one, but one that felt the most significant, maybe, based on where these teams are right now, and that was the Broncos going into Dallas and really just controlling this game from beginning to end, just a few days after trading arguably their best player in Von Miller. So they go down there, really a dominant defensive performance, and look, we'll get into Dak Prescott in a second, but this was a Vic Fangio defense that was sort of operating at its highest level, especially in defensive backfield, where we know they have one of the best secondaries in football, and the number of times where they batted balls away at the catch point or punched it out of a receiver's hands as he was trying to pull it in, there were just so many of those plays during this game that really spoiled everything the Cowboys were trying to do.
Yeah. Connor Orr has been touting the Broncos defense all season. He said they were going to be one of the best defenses in the NFL. It's just kind of ironic that we really see the best example of that right after they trade away Von Miller. But they really shut down the Cowboys offense, and Dak Prescott had been completing passes at a rate over 70%, which was excellent. He was at about 50% in this game, which is just as you alluded to, Gary, a lot of passes just batted away and broken up. Dak Prescott was also asked after the game a lot about his calf. This was his first game back after injuring his calf, and calf injuries really linger a lot. That was one of the things I learned early on covering the NFL, is that it sounds like it's not that big of an injury, right? You know, it's not like an ACL or it's not a high ankle sprain, but they have a tendency to really linger and can impact players at every position because it's just a really important muscle into what players do on the field. Now, Prescott said he wasn't limited and that it didn't bother him at all and that, you know, he was totally fine. But I think Mike McCarthy kind of referenced the speed of the game, you know, having to get back used to that. So it seems like there may have been some physical limitations, either just even if the injury isn't per se bothering him specifically, but just coming in back off of the time he missed.
Yeah, he definitely had a couple of misfires. And like I said, I think this game was about the Broncos defense really just outplaying everyone else on the field. But Prescott just misfired a couple of times. I mean, there's one fourth down play where, he extended the play. CeeDee Lamb had broken wide open downfield, and he just overshot him by like a good 5 yards. And those are the kind of plays we just don't really, we don't see the Cowboys miss that often. We haven't seen Dak Prescott miss them very often over the years. So you wonder if there were some lingering effects, maybe just some rust. I mean, it happens. But, that combined with the Broncos' defensive performance, it was just, it turned ugly. And look, the final score of 30-16 looks a little bit respectable, but this was, this was pure garbage time when they got those 16 points. This was a 30-0 game with 5 minutes to go. I do just want to, bring up the fact that the Broncos' run game was excellent in this one. Javonte Williams, the rookie running back, was just dragging tacklers throughout this game. I don't think it's time to say, oh boy, is this Cowboys defense starting to regress, back to last year's form or 2019? This felt like a 2019 Cowboys defensive performance, though, where they didn't tackle well. They didn't get a takeaway in this one. They did get some pressure upfield. They did get to Teddy Bridgewater a little bit, but, goodness, they just kind of got run over. I mean, the Broncos ended up controlling the clock for more than 41 minutes. It was a pretty good butt kicking.
Yeah, and it was also surprising to see after the Miller trade, because when you trade a player like Von Miller away, it seems like, okay, you're kind of packing up for the season. But this was a reminder the Broncos can hang around there, especially in an AFC that is totally chaotic right now. But yeah, it was for the Cowboys, it was just kind of a regressive performance. Maybe it was just one of those games that was trap game or a womp womp game that you kind of just write off as an outlier and move on. But the inability to stop the run and to take the ball away were certainly reminiscent of 2019.
We'll see what unfolds coming up for a Dan Quinn group that really they've overachieved. They just played so much better than they have the last couple of seasons. And this one was a little bit of a raised eyebrow after this one. But let's go to the Battle of Ohio here.
Browns Bengals.
So Odell Beckham Jr. forces his way out of Cleveland. We had talked about this a little bit before it happened on the Trade Deadline podcast. You can go back one back in your feed if you want to listen to that one. So Odell is out, and the Browns end up going to Cincinnati against a team that's leading their division, no matter what you think of the Bengals. And they win the way they won without Odell Beckham Jr. a year ago. And this was a team that went into Pittsburgh and won a playoff game and then went to Kansas City and was right there in the end of a playoff game. I don't know, Jenny. I wish Connor were here to hear this. And maybe he'll reveal on the next show why he is not around this week. But I just think the Browns are going to end up over the next couple of weeks reestablishing themselves as one of the blue bloods in the AFC.
Yeah, I think this was a real addition by subtraction situation. And I like how the Browns handled it. Kevin Stefanski, Andrew Berry, they were pretty decisive. And they said, listen, this isn't going to work. Like, Odell obviously wants out, and the way he's handling it is not going to be good for our locker room. And so, we weren't able to trade him at the trade deadline, which indicates what the rest of the league thinks of him, of Odell right now at this point in time. You know, potentially diminished abilities, and do you want to introduce, another factor into the locker room, a player who wants the ball and can potentially put pressure on your quarterback? I don't know how, all of those things that went into it, but ultimately no other team was willing to take on the contract and give up whatever capital they would have to exchange. But the Browns said, okay, fine, we're going to move on even without, having made a trade before the deadline. this is what's best for our locker room. And the Browns played like a team that had a weight lifted off their shoulder. And I don't mean to equate, like, certainly on-field drama or locker room drama is not the worst thing that goes on and not the worst topic that we have to discuss. So I don't want to, like, overstate it. But it wasn't a marriage that was working. And so the Browns figured out a way to come up with a solution that worked for everybody. And they played like a team that was really happy to have that behind them, that was really happy to move forward without Odell in their locker room.
And it might be a happy divorce for both sides. Odell Beckham Jr., we'll see where he lands in the coming days. And if he has a big finish of the season, he might be in for a significant third contract coming up here with whomever might want to sign him this upcoming offseason. But it really was stylistically how the Browns want to do it, which is they got out to a lead. Nick Chubb got going. They worked some play action off of that run threat and got some big plays downfield. And I do want to highlight, because I don't want to say law of averages just dominates the NFL when it's all said and done, but this is a Browns defense. And Jenny, you know as much about turnovers and forcing turnovers as anyone. Generally, if you have a dominant pass rush, you should be expected to maybe have more takeaways than a team that doesn't. You know, you're going to force your opponent to play faster than they want to, play off schedule a little more than they want to, have to adjust after the snap in ways that they just don't want to. This Browns defense was not taking the ball. They had 5 takeaways coming to this game. Only the Jaguars had fewer. In this game, they get on the very opening drive. You know, Bengals are moving the ball. They get a long They get a long pick six touchdown, Denzel Ward, 99 yards. They got another downfield fumble takeaway in the second quarter. They got another fumble takeaway in the third quarter. I mean, this was, it was an interception in the third quarter. But this was a game where they took the ball away 3 times and didn't give away at all. And that is, it's not going to be 3-0 every week, but I think this is a defense that can kind of look at it and say, we should be taking it away at least once a week, sometimes 2 or 3. And if they do that, it really, if you can steal that many possessions over the course of a year, they're going to win a lot of games here with what they have formulaically offensively.
Gary, before we recorded, you warned me that this was going to be a show about turnover margin and the law of averages. And I just want to say that you have really delivered.
That's just the beginning. That's my opening.
Oh boy.
That's my opening salve there. Yeah, we got more of that coming up. Just wait till we get to those Jaguars.
Cardinals, 49ers.
So yeah, a formula for winning games in the NFL is have your starting quarterback go down and just have Colt McCoy start against a quality opponent on the road, and you'll go and do it. He did with the Giants last year, went up to Seattle and won a game there. Now, this one was a little bit different than what they did against the Giants. Against the Seahawks last year with the Giants, where it was a run-heavy, defense-heavy type of performance. Colt McCoy had to do a little bit of lifting here, and he did it very well. I mean, they got a lead, so that always keeps things on schedule a little bit more and allows you to sort of stay with your game plan for your backup quarterback. But in the end, the Cardinals just go into Santa Clara and grab that lead and just don't let go.
Yeah, well, Gary, our colleague Frankie Whispers Fantasy, he predicted, he was on top of this on Friday, I believe it was, that Kyler Murray and DeAndre Hopkins would be out. I regretted my Cardinals pick a little bit at that point, but I hung with it. And we have a lot of people who don't like us in Arizona, Gary, people who thought that we were a little bit too low on the Cardinals. But this was a impressive performance. And, not only do you have your backup quarterback in there, but you are down your top receiver. So that never makes things easy on the backup quarterback, but they were able to get another division win. And I mean, not have it affect what's been a tremendous season so far.
I called the Cardinals Super Bowl contenders and didn't hear the end of it for an entire week because I had to proclaim them the best team of all time, I guess. But yeah, as far as look, Colt McCoy was very backup quarterback savvy in this one. You know, there were a handful of just subtle little plays. Like there was a long completion early in the second half where, you know, he tucked the ball under his arm. It looked like he was going to run and escape the pressure by scrambling, and he just reloaded and found a receiver downfield. You know, they did a lot of screen stuff. They had a trick play mixed in that ended up being a Christian Kirk pass down to, I believe it was Antoine Wesley down at the goal line there. So they had a bag of tricks, and then James Conner just sort of steamrolled people, and Chase Edmonds had gotten hurt early in this one. It was James Conner. It was Eno Benjamin coming off the bench, and on one hand, you want to say ton of credit to those Cardinals backs. I mean, they were difficult to tackle the entire game. And on the other hand, you look at the 49ers and say, boy, this is a team that sort of identifies itself as physical and sure tackling. And boy, did this one get away from them in a way that is just not going to taste good when they rewatch the film.
As well as Colt McCoy played, the team is clearly at its best when it has Kyler Murray in there. And I think that was one of our reservations with the Cardinals in their hot start early on, Gary, is that Murray has a propensity to get banged up because he's such a huge part of the offense. I mean, obviously he's the quarterback, so you're a huge part of the offense, but he's like the offense for the Cardinals. And so it'll be something to keep an eye on moving forward, you know, when he's able to return from the ankle injury, but also are there any other nagging injuries that can result from the style of play that he uses. But as for the 49ers, it's been a pretty disappointing season for them so far. There were high expectations, you know, Jimmy Garoppolo will play until it's time to put Lance in, and it's not even this performance. The defense was incredibly disappointing, as you referenced, Gary, and really has seemingly lost a lot of the identity that we had seen from the defense the year they went to the Super Bowl.
It was, and that's the thing. We all kind of wondered, okay, well, what's the quarterback situation going to be? How's it going to play out? And look, this got off to just sort of a weird start for them because, you know, they lost two early downfield fumbles, you know, completions where George Kittle lost a fumble and then Brandon Ayuk lost one in the red zone. And those are just kind of fluky plays. I mean, there's not a whole lot you can say. Jimmy Garoppolo played fine in this one, even when they had fallen behind and, you know, the play action game becomes a little less effective than it is. Garoppolo overall was fine. The issue was just the second and third level defenders were just, it was tough to watch if you were a believer in this 49ers defense. And I do really like what D'Amico Ryans has done with this group, but I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do with this cornerbacking group because they all just looked like they were not good enough in this one. More flags for Josh Norman. He got into it with Cliff Kingsbury. Cliff actually got flagged too, but Josh Norman had been flagged before Cliff, and because of that, Josh's was considered after the play, so it was an automatic first down after a third down stop, whereas Cliff's just backed them up 15 yards for a first down. Josh Norman just continues to struggle. He's just at that point in his career. And Dre Kirkpatrick came in. I don't think Norman played another snap after that flag. Kirkpatrick came in and got steamrolled by Eno Benjamin, who's, you know, your opponent's third round cornerback, and you have to make those tackles, especially when you're playing from behind in a game and trying to keep a team from scoring touchdowns. That's, yeah, I don't know what the answer is, but their cornerback play is just hugely problematic at this point.
Yeah, and that's not a position that you want to not have answers at, because you can't really create answers. Either you have the players to defend on the back end or you don't. And, you know, as we've seen the Rams do, right, they get players of impact at the positions that matter the most, and they make sure that their roster is well studded at those spots. Cornerback is certainly one of those spots.
Well, let's go on to the upset of the day here, who just ruined everyone's knockout pools around the country.
Bills Jaguars.
So, yeah, look, the Jaguars defense, the Jaguars much maligned defense going up against the Bills and the NFL's highest scoring defense coming in this week, ends up holding Josh Allen and this Buffalo offense to 6 points and get a 9-6 win in what was, it was not beautiful football, but that's the way they did it. And I do want to, one, give Jaguars defensive coordinator Joe Cullen a virtual pat on the back. It was an interesting matchup because this is a Jaguars defense that has really struggled against offenses that are maybe a little more highly schemed, a little more on schedule, and usually that's what happens to bad defenses. You just, an offensive game plan comes in and you can't stop it. Whether it be, you know, we saw the Texans do it to him. We saw the Dolphins have a lot of success moving the ball against them and kind of no one else this season. And in this game, you know, Josh Allen is a guy who does not necessarily want to play on schedule all the time. He wants to get late in the down. He wants to improvise. He wants to stress a defense as much as possible. You have to be incredibly disciplined against that to not give up these big plays. And the Jaguars were. They were absolutely up to the task in this one.
Yeah, I mean, it was just a stunning result. You wonder how much of a boost the Jaguars' Josh Allen got out of playing the Bills' Josh Allen. I mean, it was like a running joke all week. Would he sack him? And NFL Network looked up if a player had ever sacked another player with the exact same name, which apparently had not happened. And there are all these funny things about it. But then he just plays totally out of his mind. I mean, he has a trifecta of big plays and was a huge factor in this stunning result.
He had a sack. He had an interception, which Josh Allen had an interception. He had his first career interception as a defensive end. And then he had a fumble recovery as the Jaguars sealed the game in the fourth quarter there. And that's the other thing I will bring up. We will go back to the law of averages because that's what it all comes down to in this league. The Jaguars had two takeaways on the season, league low, coming into this game. And again, even if you are a struggling day, usually you just get you get a tip pass, you get a botched quarterback center exchange that you fall on, you get some special teams for it. Like, just that stuff tends to just happen every once in a while. It hadn't been happening for the Jaguars, and all of a sudden they get three turnovers in this game. They get three takeaways. They get more than they had the entire season combined thus far. And that's what ends up being the difference in what, again, was, I mean, my goodness, if you didn't watch the game, I would never encourage you to go back and watch this. It was not beautiful football. Josh Allen and Trevor Lawrence are both tremendously talented, and it was kind of difficult to watch them struggle the way they did in this one. Not to mention, I'm not going to get too far into the officiating, but the officiating was bizarre, almost like performance art bad in this one. They were really having a tough time the entire game. But yeah, the Jaguars end up outplaying the Bills and coming away with a victory here.
Yeah, and the Bills' offense has kind of hit a rough patch here too. And again, similar to we discussed with the Chiefs, I mean, they're not in similar situations, but when an offense kind of slows down after being good for a long time, like, is it just a slump? Can they snap out of it quickly? And I think those are similar questions at the least for Buffalo.
Well, let's go out to another upset. This is a good old NFC South rivalry.
Falcons Saints.
So yeah, Atlanta goes into New Orleans and ends up stealing a victory from the Saints here. And really, we all, we all queue up our 28-3 jokes every time the Falcons blow a big lead, but they end up coming back and retaking the lead and winning this one, again, on the road against the Saints. And it's a Falcons team that, as we've seen this year, it's undermanned anyway. Calvin Ridley's also out, so they're a little shorthanded on offense. And really impressive performance for them. I think the thing that the two of us were wondering, and I don't even think it because we discussed it, but it was really surprising that Taysom Hill not only didn't get the start at quarterback, he played limited snaps at quarterback. It wasn't even like a platoon system with Jameis Winston now out for the year. It was Trevor Siemian ended up getting the action here for the Saints. And look, it's if he's your quarterback, you want to be highly schemed. You want to play within your game plan and that sort of stuff. It was a drop happy receiving core. It's not a very good receiving core, and they just really, it just feels like they don't really have the supporting cast to lift up the offense the way it has to be lifted up if Trevor's your quarterback.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a head scratcher because we saw how hard the Saints worked to keep Taysom Hill to ensure that he would stay a Saint. There was a whole competition between him and Jameis Winston. Jameis Winston won the competition, so you would think when Winston is out and lost for the season that Hill would be the starter. It'll be interesting, I guess, to see what they do moving forward. Hill was coming off the concussion. He was cleared to practice, I think, Wednesday. I'm not sure if that was a factor in it, or maybe they didn't think the offense that they wanted to run with Hill would be effective against the Falcons. There's a lot of potential factors to consider, but it's surprising, for as much as we've heard Sean Payton talk up Taysom Hill the last couple of years, that he would rather start Trevor Siemian over him.
It's like you can build something around him. And I don't know if he's necessarily, I don't think he's a guy I'd term like, here's a starting quarterback in the NFL. It's a unique skill set, but it's something you can build around. I mean, you get the 11-man run game going. I mean, you can do stuff with him that you just, I don't know. I don't know what this offense is supposed to be, because it wasn't really good enough with Jameis under center. And I don't know if going to a sort of traditional quarterback downgrade is the way you're going to sort of lift things up there. And we know the defense is good enough to win games anyway. And look, they were there. I mean, they were winning this game 25-24. Their defense is really good. They just gave up points when it was all said and done. But yeah, it is. It's truly head scratching. And maybe we're missing something. And maybe, I don't know, maybe Taysom Hill retired 4 years ago and we just missed it or something. But the only other thing that popped into my head was he faced the Falcons twice last year. And maybe the thinking was, okay, the Falcons have already seen him twice. It's sort of a unique, sort of limited usage type of offense you do with Taysom Hill. So maybe they thought, maybe Sean Payton sort of decided this is not something we sustain for a third matchup at this point. But I don't know. It's strange. After all those afternoons of forcing him onto the field when Drew Brees was their quarterback, now it's like they have these other dudes, and it's like, nah, we don't have room for you, sorry. Now that the Hall of Famer's gone,
it's exactly right, Gary. It's such a swing from, oh wow, Taysom Hill is out there again, and they flash to Drew Brees on the sideline and he looks mildly annoyed. So you think that when Drew Brees is retired that Taysom Hill would be the guy or be a large part of the offense. I mean, he had a chance to be the guy. I know he had a training camp competition with Winston, but okay, so they go to Winston instead, but then Winston's injured and they're not going to Hill. It's just sort of a strange set of circumstances. I had a dream Saturday night that the Saints won the Super Bowl, so this Falcons loss was a big blow to my prognostication abilities. I'm clearly no oracle here, but they do have the kind of defense you can win a Super Bowl with, and I think the fact that they're now searching for answers at quarterback is kind of unfortunate, because they would be a fun team to watch this year, if they had a quarterback, which I guess is true of a lot of teams. I will note that the Falcons are now, I think they would be in position to make the playoffs. I mean,
is that right?
They're 4-4. I think they would be in the 7th seed slot for the NFC.
Wow.
I just pulled the standings up while we're recording, but that's on a cursory look, that's what it appears. So,
We should do a 9-week season just to have playoff teams like that. But it was a nice win for the Falcons. Nothing else you can say. But yeah, I don't know. I guess the conspiratorial side of me just kind of wonders, like, Sean Payton, does he just have something in his pocket that he doesn't want to break out in November, that he just wants to pull out in January? And I don't know. This one was, it's weird. Just really weird.
Don't you have to pull it out, though, in November to make sure you get to January?
Maybe he's saying, look, I'm in a conference where the Falcons can make the playoffs. We're going to make
that's
it anyway.
That's true. That seven seed in the NFC is going to be an interesting one.
It's going to make people angry.
Vikings, Ravens.
All right, let's do one more before we get to the lightning-ish round, and that is out in Baltimore. The Vikings. Oh, the Vikings. So, look, this Vikings team, no matter what happens during a game, they seem to always come down to, like, the final possession. They should really be on every, like, Sunday night and Monday night game because it always comes down to the very end. And it is a game they led 24-10 after returning the second half kickoff for a touchdown, and you got a 2-touchdown lead, and you're kind of in control here, and they just let the Ravens drive for 3 straight touchdowns, surrounded by a couple of Vikings punts, and then it takes Kirk Cousins to do another Kirk Cousins late game heroics thing to get them into the end zone. But the thing that drove me nuts more than the fact that they just sort of played themselves into a close game that shouldn't have been a close game was I just wish they had gone for 2 in the win at the end of regulation. It just didn't add up. I know there's like that instinct for everyone to just be like, well, extend the game. You don't want to lose it here. You'd rather just play on. But it didn't add up to anything that made sense to me.
No, I agree, especially against the Ravens, because the Ravens, you know, are a team that will gamble or make aggressive decisions. They have that whole persona. Also, importantly, they have Justin Tucker. So yeah. Don't you just want to try to end the game when you can, because you know that the other team has this great advantage and that you are a team that has been cursed by some wrongdoing to a kicker in some year past. I'm not sure what has happened. They haven't been able to exercise this demon. So, yes, I would just really want to end it right then and there when you have the chance.
And that's the other part of it, right? Wasn't a part of Mike Zimmer, like, just resisting sending Greg Joseph out for a potential game-winning kick, even though it was just a PAT? Apparently not. So, yeah, the other thing was, besides the kicker difference here, and besides the fact you're on the road, their defense had been out there for so long at that point. They played 71 snaps in this game because, again, there were plays, there were a couple of long plays for the Vikings. They had the kickoff return TD. That tends to put your defense out on the field more often, and they just looked gassed in the second half. And then it was kind of like, okay, well, we'll get the tie, and then we will, you know, hopefully win the overtime toss and drive for a touchdown instead of just going for it from the 2 right now. And they lost the toss, and they actually got a turnover, but it didn't work out anyway. So it kind of almost worked out, but again, just, it's just gut-wrenching right now if you're a Vikings fan.
Yeah, I don't know how many of those games you can go through if you're a player or coach. I mean, it just has to be exhausting, the emotional roller coaster of it all. As for the Ravens, you have to admire their fortitude. This game, the Colts game, were both times when they had to really make late rallies and win in overtime. They were able to do that both times. Of course, they had that bad game. I don't know what other modifier to use. The bad loss to the Bengals, and it looked like they were on their way to another one, but they found a way to, you know, come from behind and win. And that had been one of the criticisms of the Ravens all along, right? Is that the way they play offense and their run first approach makes it harder to come from behind. And so this season, they've really been able to correct that narrative and say, hey, we can win a lot of different ways, and we're good enough to do come from behind victories. I mean, obviously you don't want to fall into a deficit and have to come from behind, but that happens in the NFL. And I feel like that is another strength that we've seen this team show that they hadn't in past seasons.
It was. And look, it was a lot of, sustained drives to sort of do this comeback. It wasn't like one of those things where it's like, oh, they got a 6-yard touchdown and that sort of cut things quickly. They you know, kept leaning on the run game. They end up rushing 45 times in this game for 247, again, with just, you know, these guys were great pros in their prime, but, like, you know, it's like Lamar had 120, and then Devontae Freeman was 79, and Le'Veon Bell was 48 in a touchdown, and including a big fourth down conversion. So, yeah, that's the way it went here for Baltimore, and they just keep on finding a way. That's something to be admired at this point.
But don't you sometimes see, like, flashes? You'll watch Le'Veon Bell run, for instance, and you see him kind of do his patented little pause at the line of scrimmage and then break through. And you're like, yeah, I remember that. Like, I see flashes here and there.
I really like Le'Veon Bell, and I'm bummed how it sort of wrapped up for him.
Yeah.
One in Pittsburgh and then two with the Jets. But yeah, that's the thing. It's kind of like he also, so much of his value with the Steelers in his prime was the fact that, yeah, you could split him out. You know, he could be a multi-purpose weapon, and he's kind of not that, or he's not used in that way in this offense, which makes it an even weirder fit. But it's effective enough at this point. He belongs out there. Let's go to the lightning-ish round, and we are going to start this one in Philadelphia.
Chargers, Eagles.
So yeah, I'm going to term this a weird game, even though it kind of wasn't weird. It was just so many sustained drives in a row for both sides. And on one hand, it's like, yeah, it's Justin Herbert, you know, great game, great performance again. We're kind of used to that from him. You know, he ends up throwing for 356. They end up getting points on their on all four of their second half drives in a game that they win 27-24 in the final seconds on Dustin Hopkins' field goal. But also Jalen Hurts, you know, he stuck around. It was still a lot of stuff on the ground from the Eagles. It's still a little bit limited. I wish they'd sort of, I mean, at some point you just have to open it up and sort of figure out, okay, is this guy going to be our guy or not? But Jalen Hurts got it done. He sort of went shot for shot here with Herbert, and you know, Herbert just ended up having the ball last.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I think it was a weird game, because you would have never predicted Jalen Hurts to hang with Justin Herbert heading into the game. But this was a really good performance for him. And it's been a strange season for the Eagles. Some weeks they look like they have no idea what they're doing, and then other weeks they have games like this. So it's not the worst thing to give Jalen Hurts a chance and see what he does the rest of the season.
Still, we're going to talk about this come January and February and whatever else, but it's still just the weirdest thing in the world that it's like they took Jalen Hurts in the second round, and then they were just like, clearly a developmental quarterback, and then they're just like in year two, like, nah, like, we don't think he can do it, so we'll look on. They had four scoring drives of 10 plays or more in this game. It was good. He hasn't always been good, but you see signs like this every once in a while that you can you can at least try to build around him. They just, I don't know, for whatever reason, they don't quite seem to have the appetite for it. Let's go over to East Rutherford for another, let's call it a mini upset.
Raiders, Giants.
So yeah, the Giants knock off the Raiders here. This snaps a, what was it? It was a two-game winning streak for the Raiders, but two games in the post-Gruden era here that they had won. But this was, if you are critical of Jason Garrett, you got plenty more fuel in this one, because it's just really frustrating watching the Giants kind of really just not show a whole lot of interest in scoring points at this point. But Patrick Graham's defense was excellent in this one, and Xavier McKinney, the second-year safety, had a couple of interceptions, including a pick six, and I thought both of those plays were... I used to always say this about the defensive backs in, like, Brandon Staley's defense last year. It's just the sign of a really instinctive player who's been coached up really well, and I thought that was both of those interceptions for McKinney, where he just made plays that a lot of young guys wouldn't make because you don't quite have that mental Rolodex yet, but he has been just... he's been well prepared to play in this defense.
Yeah, they were excellent plays by McKinney, Gary, but also Derek Carr was just a little bit off, target. Some of his throws weren't 100% accurate. It's been a long season for the Raiders, and it was a devastating week with Henry Ruggs being charged with multiple felonies, including driving under the influence resulting in death. So there's a lot of bigger things than football that this team is dealing with. And this week, they just looked like maybe they had other things on their mind, which would be understandable.
Patriots, Panthers.
So, Sam Darnold, I don't know. It's like he gets traded to the NFC, and it's like, well, okay, he won't have to face Belichick anymore. That'll be good for his development. And just whatever, for whatever reason, the schedule happens to rotate, and he had a Panthers-Patriots matchup. And I just been thinking all week, like, I should write something on how, like, Belichick is just owned Darnold. And it's like, no, it just, I don't know. One, it seems like piling on. Two, it's just one of those things where it's like, you know what, these guys are professionals, and after a while you figure it out, and, you know, maybe we'll probably get like a middling performance. Maybe they don't win, but that's the way it'll play out. But no, this was just another really kind of horrific performance for Darnold against the Patriots defense.
Yeah, and the Panthers' early 3-0 record was fool's gold, but mostly because it was a fool's gold performance by Darnold. We thought maybe he'd improved and gotten past the turnovers, and since then we've seen him be the same quarterback that he was in New York and make a lot of bad decisions, not smart decisions. I mean, some of the interceptions today, Gary, like, it was hard to understand what he could have been thinking, and clearly that was the feeling on the sideline as well. You saw a lot of frustration from Robbie Anderson on the sideline and also after the game, basically saying, like, we're doing the same thing over and over again and nothing's working. And obviously Darnold isn't their answer. The Panthers have not so secretly been on the quarterback market. They're trying to find their franchise guy. They determined that Bridgewater wasn't good enough, but all along it was a baffling decision to say Bridgewater wasn't good enough, but maybe Darnold is. I think we've seen enough at this point to know that that's not the case.
It was a, it was the mystery box is what it came down to. You could have had the $1,000 cash, but maybe the mystery box had something else better in it. All right. And finally, we are wrapping the show up with what was billed as the worst game of the season.
Texans, Dolphins.
But to be honest, this probably was the worst game of the season. This was just really bad football between the Dolphins and the Texans. The Dolphins end up hanging on here. You know, it was a game that featured, I mean, what we had, let's see, 9 turnovers? Is that right? Nine turnovers. Wow. From a couple of, I mean, Tyrod Taylor's whole thing is he doesn't turn the ball over. He had 3 interceptions in this game. Jacoby Brissett, it continues to be a victim of this Dolphins offense where they just insist on running. It makes no sense. They insist on running the Tua Tagovailoa offense with Jacoby Brissett under center. And stylistically, you could not get 2 quarterbacks less like each other than those 2 guys. So it's not his fault when things go wrong. But man, I don't know. I don't know what to say about this game other than we had 3 points in the second half. And the Dolphins won 17-9. They snapped their losing streak. The Texans' losing streak continues.
There was a lot of bad football play this weekend. A lot of matchups where both teams looked bad. We've mentioned a few of them earlier. The fact that this was by far the worst says all you need to know about the game. And also that you initially left this game off the timeline for the show. And we're trying to figure out the game that you missed. And it was Dolphins-Texans.
It would have been the easiest way to build the timeline, build the outline by just putting this in the last spot and then working backwards. The MMQB NFL podcast is Jenny Vrentis and me, Gary Gramling. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Thanks as always to senior podcast producer Dan Bloom, who guides us in a way that no one else can. Mark Moravik is emeritus editor of the MMQB. Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL podcast. Be sure to subscribe to this feed on Apple Podcasts. And once you do, leave a rating and review, please, because it really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.